Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we have a monumental task in front of us.
That's putting it lightly.
We are tackling the foundational pillars of the physical universe, pulling from a stack of source material that spans 15 entire chapters of physics fundamentals.
It's a true crash course.
It really is. A crash course in the building blocks of reality.
That's absolutely right. For you, the learner, we're running a true deep dive, not just a quick summary. We are moving from the most basic definitions of classical mechanics, you know, how things fall,
right,
all the way through the mind-bending realities of quantum spin, why certain atoms are effectively little magnets, and how those microscopic behaviors are leveraged in massive real-world technologies like MRI.
It's an enormous scope, from establishing the very language we use to measure the world to understanding why the sky is blue to the exact mechanism inside a microwave oven.
Uh-huh.
Our mission is to take this sprawling knowledge base and distill the core indispensable ideas, the real aha moments, and show you how they all connect. We need to be efficient, but also thorough. Okay, let's unpack this.
And we'll focus constantly on bridging that gap. We start with the macroscopic world that, you know, Isaac Newton described, where we can see forces in motion, and we will consistently move toward the microscopic principles that govern everything, the world of energy conservation and quantum probability.
We have to start at the absolute beginning, defining the terms. If physics is the language of the universe, chapter one gives us the alphabet and the grammar.
It has to start there. Physics describes nature using measurement and mathematics. Every single description we use relies on a physical quantity.
And that's not just a number.
Never just a number. It must always be composed of a numerical value and an appropriate unit. You can't just say 9.11 times 10 to the minus 31.
No context.
Right. You must specify kilograms for that to be the mass of an electron.
And these quantities immediately split into two categories, reflecting the fundamental nature of what we measure versus what we calculate.
Precisely. We have the seven fundamental base quantities, which are defined by international convention and are independent of each other.
The ones we all learned in school.
You know them. Length, the meter, mass, the kilogram, time, the second, and then the slightly more technical ones. Electric current, the ampere, thermodynamic temperature, the Kelvin.
Amount of substance, the mole.
And luminous intensity, the candela. Every single other quantity you can think of, from speed to force to density to energy, is a derived quantity constructed mathematically by combining those seven base quantities.
The power of this system, the International System of Units, or SI, is that it provides a globally consistent framework. But what's truly powerful is how it allows us to check our work even before we plug in a single number. That's dimensional analysis.
Dimensional analysis is an incredible safety net for scientists. It's almost a philosophical check on your work.
That's so.
It strips away the specific units and leaves only the fundamental dimensions. Mass, which we'll call M, length L, and time T.
Okay.
If a physical equation is correct, the dimensions on the left side of the equation must exactly match the dimensions on the right side. We call this being dimensionally homogeneous.
So instead of just reciting the formula for the period of a pendulum, let's focus on the idea. We know the period is a measure of time, so its dimension has to be T.
Right. And if the equation governing that period is correct, everything on the right side, the length of the string, the gravitational acceleration, must combine mathematically so that the end result simplifies down perfectly to T.
And if it doesn't?
If you mix up the variables and accidentally multiply length by gravity, your dimensions won't resolve to T, and you know instantly the relationship is wrong. It confirms the structure of the equation, which is far more profound than just checking the arithmetic.
Once we have the right units, we run into the next problem. Is the measurement a simple number, or does it have a critical direction attached? This is the non-negotiable split between scalars versus vectors.
This is a foundational concept. Scalars are magnitude only: mass, time, temperature, or energy. They obey simple arithmetic.
Easy enough.
But vectors require both magnitude and direction to be fully defined. Think of navigating by GPS. If I tell you I need to move 10 kilometers, that's a scalar distance.
It's not very helpful information.
Not at all. But if I tell you I need to move 10 kilometers due northeast, that's a vector displacement. Now you know what to do.
So displacement, velocity, force, and electric fields all fall into the vector category. And because they have direction, we can't just add them up using standard arithmetic.
Exactly. They require vector algebra, the parallelogram law, or the triangle law, which accounts for their relative directions. We manage this complexity by using vector decomposition.
Which is just breaking it down into pieces.
That's it. We break a vector, let's call it A, down into perpendicular components, usually along the x and y axis, A sub x and A sub I.
So the vector A becomes A sub x times the x unit vector I plus A sub y times the unit vector j.
Right. And once it's decomposed, we can use simple trigonometry and the Pythagorean theorem to reconstruct the total length, the magnitude, and the exact angle or direction of that vector. It's the tool that lets us tackle multidimensional physics problems using simple linear math.
Now, in the real world, this perfect math is always undermined by reality. We face measurement limits.
No measurement is perfect, ever. And we must report that uncertainty, honestly.
So we have to be clear on the difference between accuracy and precision. I often think of it like target practice.
That's a great analogy. Go with that.
Okay, so accuracy is how close your shot is to the bullseye, the true value.
Right. Low accuracy is usually caused by systematic errors, a consistent bias, like a zero offset on a scale, or maybe the sight on your rifle is always aimed 5 degrees too far left.
Precision, on the other hand, is reproducibility. It's how tightly grouped your shots are, regardless of whether they hit the bullseye.
Yes. And precision is affected by random errors, things like a sudden gust of wind, electronic noise in your instrument, or slight human inconsistency.
The beauty of random errors, though, is that if you take multiple shots or multiple measurements and average them,
they tend to cancel each other out. Your average gets closer and closer to the true value, significantly increasing your overall reliability.
And when we calculate with these imperfect numbers, we have to respect the limitations of the input data using significant figures.
This is all about honesty and reporting. I mean, if your bathroom scale only reads to the nearest tenth of a kilogram, and you use that number in a complex calculation, your final answer cannot magically suggest precision down to the thousandth of a kilogram.
You have to trim the result.
You must. So, when multiplying or dividing, we look at the inputs, and the result must have the same number of significant figures as the term with the fewest significant figures.
And the rule for adding and subtracting is a little different.
It is. The result must match the input with the fewest decimal places. These rules ensure that our calculated results never suggest a level of precision that wasn't actually achieved during the initial measurement.
Chapter 1 closes with a crucial philosophical caveat about the entire discipline, the reliance on models versus reality.
Physics couldn't function without simplified representations or idealizations. We use the point particle model to analyze motion without worrying about complex rotation or shape.
Right, like treating a whole planet as a single point in space for orbital mechanics.
Exactly. Or we analyze an ideal gas by assuming the particles have no volume and don't interact, which simplifies thermodynamics dramatically.
These models are highly effective, but we must always understand their limits of validity.
Think of it this way. Classical mechanics is a fantastic model for macroscopic objects moving at ordinary speeds, like launching a baseball. But the moment that baseball accelerates close to the speed of light,
it breaks down.
Classical mechanics fails, and we need special relativity. The moment we zoom in on the atomic structure of the baseball, classical mechanics fails again, and we need quantum mechanics. Knowing where the model breaks is often more important than knowing the model itself.
So now that we have the language, Chapter 2 applies it to motion itself. Kinematics is the description of how things move, their speed, position, and acceleration, without yet asking why they are moving.
Yes, the why comes later. First, we define position relative to a chosen origin point, and we immediately must distinguish distance from displacement.
This is the first vector versus scalar hurdle. If I walk from my office to the vending machine 10 meters away and then walk directly back, my total distance traveled is 20 meters. That's the total path length, a scalar.
But your displacement, the vector change in position, is 0 meters.
Because I ended up where I started.
Exactly. Your initial and final positions are identical. Displacement cares only about the endpoints, making it a powerful description of net change.
Then we introduce time, bringing in velocity and acceleration. Instantaneous velocity is the rate of change of position, the speed at a specific moment in time.
And velocity, v of t, is a vector. Its magnitude is speed, which is a scalar.
And acceleration?
Acceleration, a of t, is the rate of change of velocity. If you accelerate, you're changing your speed, your direction, or both. A lot of people forget about the direction part.
The moment we assume acceleration is constant, like the acceleration due to gravity on Earth, we get our powerful toolkit, the four equations of motion.
These equations, often called the kinematic equations, are incredibly useful for prediction. If we know the initial velocity and constant acceleration of an object, we can mathematically predict its position, its final velocity, and the time it takes to achieve that state.
They're the mathematical backbone of projectile motion.
Completely. But all these descriptions depend entirely on who is watching. Motion is fundamentally relative, requiring a reference frame.
Our description of motion is tied to our own coordinate system.
Right. And the most important frame is the inertial frame. This is where Newton's first law holds true. If you are sitting on a train moving at a constant speed in a straight line, your frame is inertial.
So if I toss a ball up, it comes straight down.
It comes straight down from your perspective. But the moment the train brakes or speeds up or goes around a sharp curve, you're in a non-inertial frame.
And that's where things get weird.
That's where you suddenly feel fictitious forces like being pushed forward when the car stops, which aren't caused by a physical interaction, but by the acceleration of your reference frame relative to an inertial one.
To describe motion between frames, we use relative motion. For everyday one-dimensional motion, we use the simple Galilean transformation.
A very fancy name for a simple idea. The observed velocity of an object is the vector sum of its velocity in its own moving frame plus the velocity of that frame relative to you, the observer.
This simple additive rule works beautifully for everyday speeds.
But here's the crucial caveat that foreshadows special relativity. The Galilean transformation collapses completely when speeds approach the speed of light.
Right. If you shoot a flashlight beam forward on a ship moving at 90% of the speed of light, the beam doesn't travel at 190% of c.
It can't. That violation forces us into the much more complex mathematics of the Lorentz transformation.
But sticking to everyday speeds, how do we use this vector addition in 2D? The source material uses the classic example of a boat crossing a river.
It's the perfect illustration. You were trying to find the boat's ultimate velocity relative to the riverbank, the ground. That velocity is the vector sum of two components. The velocity vector the boat generates with its own motor relative to the water, plus the velocity vector of the river's current relative to the bank.
So if the motor points straight across, but the river flows sideways,
the resulting path, the resultant vector, would be diagonal. You have to use vector geometry to figure out where you actually land on the far shore. You won't land directly opposite where you started.
If chapter 2 is the how of motion, chapter 3 is the why. This introduces forces via Newton's three laws, the ultimate foundation of classical physics.
Newton's first law, inertia, is the definition of the inertial frame we just discussed. It tells us that an object maintains constant velocity, either zero or non-zero, unless a net force acts upon it.
So you need a force to change motion, not to sustain it.
Exactly. That was the huge break from Aristotelian physics.
Then we get the workhorse, the quantifiable relationship between force and motion, the second law. Most people know EFMA.
Fundamentally, the second law states that the net force on an object is equal to the rate of change of its momentum. Now, when mass is constant, this simplifies to F net equals M times A.
And this equation defines our fundamental unit of force, the Newton N.
Right. It's the force required to accelerate a 1 kilogram mass at 1 meter per second squared.
The third law, the action-reaction law, is constantly misunderstood, perhaps because it seems too simple.
The key insight of the third law FAB equals negative FBA is that forces always come in pairs, equal in magnitude, opposite in direction.
And here's the part everyone forgets.
They always act on different objects. This is crucial. If the forces acted on the same object, nothing could ever accelerate.
Let's discuss the types of forces we encounter. We categorize them as contact forces, like friction or tension, and field forces.
Field forces are the action at a distance forces. Gravity is the most famous. Any mass M creates a gravitational field G, causing a force FG equals M times G. We also have electromagnetic fields.
The concept of the field itself was a massive historical leap, wasn't it? It allowed physics to eliminate the idea of instantaneous influence across empty space.
It was revolutionary. I mean, the field concept means that if the source of a field changes, say the moon suddenly vanishes, that change doesn't reach the Earth instantly.
The effect isn't immediate.
No. Instead, the change propagates through the field at a finite speed, the speed of light. This propagation delay is a central tenet that links dynamics to electromagnetism.
Speaking of mass and gravity, we must clarify the distinction between mass versus weight. This is where most everyday language trips up.
Oh, constantly. Mass M is intrinsic, a scalar, a measure of inertia, and it's constant whether you're on Earth, the Moon, or Mars.
Weight W, however, is a vector.
The gravitational force acting on that mass, W equals M times G. Since the gravitational field strength, G, is different everywhere, your weight is variable.
And what about the profound principle that links those two concepts, the equivalence principle?
It's perhaps the biggest implication tucked away in Chapter 3. The fact that inertial mass, the M in ESMA, resistance to motion change, is experimentally identical to gravitational mass, the M in WMA, the source of gravity.
That's not obvious.
It's not obvious at all, yet it holds true. This equivalence is what led Einstein to formulate general relativity, where he suggested gravity isn't a force operating through a field, but rather a manifestation of the curvature of space-time itself.
Before we move on, we have to properly identify action-reaction pairs. Let's use the source materials example. A book resting on a table.
Okay. The book is stationary, so the net force on it is zero. There are two main forces acting on the book. The downward pull of gravity, its weight, and the upward push of the table, the normal force.
And since the normal force equals the weight in this case, many people incorrectly assume they are an action-reaction pair.
But they can't be. Why?
Because they act on the same object, the book.
Correct. The true third law pairs involve two separate objects. The first pair is the gravitational pair. The Earth pulls the book down upon.
The book pulls the Earth up.
Exactly. The second pair is the contact pair. The book pushes the table down, and the table pushes the book up. That upward push is the normal force. Always look for the two interacting objects.
Moving beyond the forces that cause motion, we hit Chapter 4, which introduces the most fundamental and profound currency in physics, energy.
Energy is a scalar quantity defined by the state of a system. We break it down into two main types of mechanical energy. Mm. First, kinetic energy, K, energy due to motion.
Calculated as half mass times velocity squared, K equals 0.5 mV squared. It's always positive.
Right. And second is potential energy, which is stored energy due to configuration or position associated with conservative forces.
We specifically examine gravitational potential energy, UG equals MEH, which depends on height H.
And elastic potential energy, US equals 0.5 kx squared, which is stored in a spring that has been stretched or compressed by a distance x from its equilibrium position.
And the mechanism by which energy is transferred into or out of a system is defined as work, W.
Work is defined as force applied along a displacement. The formal definition, W equals FD cosine theta, reveals everything. Work is positive if the force is acting in the same direction as the displacement. It aids motion.
Work is negative if the force opposes motion, like friction.
And critically, work is zero if the force is perpendicular to the motion.
That zero work idea is highly counterintuitive. If a satellite is in a perfect circular orbit, the centripetal force is constantly pulling it toward the center of the Earth, yet that force does zero work. Why?
Because the force vector is always pointing inward, perpendicular to the satellite's direction of travel.
So it's not helping it go forward.
It's not aiding the motion at all. The speed of the satellite does not change, meaning the kinetic energy doesn't change, and thus no work is done. It's a pure direction change.
And the mathematical bridge between work and kinetic energy is the work-energy theorem.
The net work done on an object is equal to the change in its kinetic energy. W net equals delta K. It's a really powerful accounting tool.
We then define the rate at which this energy is transferred or work is done. Power, P.
Power is energy per unit time. If you apply in a constant force and maintain a velocity V, power is simply the dot product of force and velocity. The SI unit for power is the watt. 1 joule of energy transferred per second.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, the concept that underlies physics at every scale, the conservation laws.
The most encompassing principle is the conservation of total energy. For an isolated system, total energy remains constant.
It can't be created or destroyed.
It can only transform from one form to another, potential to kinetic, chemical to electrical, but the total amount in the universe is fixed.
But when we analyze a simple physical system, we usually focus on the conservation of mechanical energy. And that only holds if we ignore some real-world forces.
Yes. Mechanical energy, K plus U, is only conserved if the only forces doing work are conservative forces, like gravity or springs.
But what about friction or air resistance?
If those non-conservative forces are involved, they do non-conservative work, WNC. That non-conservative work equals the change in mechanical energy, delta EMEC.
So what happens to that lost mechanical energy?
It is transformed into non-mechanical energy, usually heat or thermal energy. It's not lost, just converted.
And we should also acknowledge the other conservation laws that govern mechanics.
Conservation of linear momentum, which is absolutely vital for analyzing collisions, and conservation of angular momentum, which explains why a spinning ice skater rotates faster when they pull their arms in.
Chapter 5 takes the principles of force and energy and applies them to repetitive motion, oscillations and waves.
Yes, and the ideal fundamental oscillation is simple harmonic motion, SHM.
It occurs when the restoring force is linear. It pushes or pulls the object back toward equilibrium with a force directly proportional to how far away it is.
That's Hooke's law, F equals negative K times X.
That relationship is fundamental because the resulting motion is always what?
Always sinusoidal, a perfect sine or cosine wave. The physical properties of the system, the spring constant K representing stiffness and the mass M representing inertia, determine the angular frequency.
So the frequency is determined by the balance between the restoring stiffness and the mass's resistance to acceleration.
Precisely. We need to define the essential terms of repetitive motion. Period, T, is the time for one complete cycle. Frequency F, measured in hertz, is the reciprocal of the period.
And for propagating disturbances waves, we add the spatial measures.
Right. Wavelength, lambda, is the distance between two consecutive peaks, and the wave speed, V, is fundamentally linked to the frequency and wavelength. V equals lambda times F.
The concept of maximizing energy transfer brings us to resonance.
Resonance is crucial in engineering and physics. It occurs when the energy delivery frequency, the external driving frequency, exactly matches the system's natural frequency.
Like pushing a child on a swing.
That's the classic example. If you time your push perfectly to their natural rhythm, their amplitude grows dramatically with minimal effort.
And we must talk about the effect of damping.
Damping is just energy loss in the system, like air resistance or an internal friction. If a system is heavily damped, the resonance peak is broad and low.
But if the damping is very low,
like in a high-quality crystal oscillator, the resonance peak is incredibly sharp and high. Even a tiny amount of input energy can cause massive oscillations.
Finally, we address standing waves. They are essential for understanding sound and light confined in a space.
Standing waves are the fascinating result of superposition, specifically two identical waves traveling in opposite directions interfering with each other. They appear stationary, storing energy, rather than propagating it.
And you get these points that don't move at all.
You have fixed points of absolutely zero displacement, called nodes, created by continuous destructive interference, and points of maximum displacement, antinodes, created by continuous constructive interference.
The existence of these nodes forces the system to abide by boundary conditions, which is why a guitar string sounds the way it does.
Exactly. If a string is fixed at both ends, those ends must be nodes. This means the length of the string, L, can only accommodate specific discrete wavelengths.
L has to be an integer number of half wavelengths.
Right. And this constraint forces the string to vibrate only at specific harmonics or overtones, generating discrete musical frequencies.
So, Chapter 6, this is the crowning achievement of 19th century physics, the unification of seemingly separate phenomena, electricity, magnetism, and light itself.
We begin with electric fields, E, which are caused by electric charge, Q, a conserved property. The force between charges is defined by Coulomb's law, inversely proportional to the square of the distance.
And the electric field is defined as the force experienced by a unit charge. Field lines always originate on positive charges.
Then we introduce magnetic fields, B. They are fundamentally different because they are produced only by moving charges or electric currents.
And here is the immediate crucial discovery. While electric charges exist as single poles, monopoles.
Magnetic monopoles have never been observed. Magnetic field lines, unlike electric ones, always form closed loops.
When a charged particle is moving through a region where both fields exist, we need the Lorentz force equation to calculate the total force on it.
The Lorentz force has two components. The electric force acts parallel to the electric field. The magnetic force, however, acts perpendicular to both the particle's velocity and the magnetic field.
And this is key.
It's absolutely key. Because if the force is always perpendicular to the direction of motion, the magnetic field component does zero work on the particle.
It changes the direction of motion, but never the speed or the kinetic energy.
Exactly.
Wait, that's counterintuitive. If the field is applying a huge force to change the direction of an electron in an accelerator, how can we say no energy is being transferred?
Because energy is defined as force multiplied by displacement in the direction of the force. Since the magnetic force always pushes the particle sideways, perpendicular to its motion, it never speeds the particle up or slows it down. The particle's kinetic energy is conserved. Only the electric field component can do work and change the particle's energy.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the ultimate genius lies in Maxwell's equations.
Maxwell synthesized four key laws, showing that electricity and magnetism aren't separate, but two sides of the same coin. Faraday's law tells us that a changing magnetic field induces an electric field. This is the principle behind electric generators.
But the breakthrough came with Maxwell's addition to the Ampere law.
Yes. The Ampere-Maxwell law revealed that a magnetic field isn't generated just by a standard current of moving charges, and also by a changing electric field.
And that created a closed loop.
It did. A changing E field creates a B field, which then changes, creating a new E field, and so on.
They become self-sustaining and start propagating through space. This mechanism creates electromagnetic waves.
Maxwell calculated the speed of this wave using only fundamental constants, the permittivity and permeability of free space. That calculated speed.
C equals 1 over the square root of mu naught epsilon naught.
Matched the speed of light that had already been measured. This was definitive proof that light itself is an electromagnetic wave. These waves are transverse. The E and B fields are perpendicular to each other, and both are perpendicular to the wave's propagation direction.
And placing the discussion of radio waves into this context is simple. They are just EM waves at the lowest frequency, longest wavelength end of that massive spectrum.
They are. And they're generated by simply accelerating charges up and down an antenna. Their long wavelengths allow them to travel great distances and even reflect off the Earth's ionosphere, enabling long-distance communication, all governed by those four Maxwell equations.
We leave the classical world of fields and forces and cross the threshold into the microscopic reality, starting with the very structure of matter in Chapter 7.
The atomic structure is surprisingly simple, yet mostly empty space. It consists of a tiny, dense, positively charged nucleus, about 10 to the minus 15 meters across, which contains over 99.9% of the atom's mass.
And this is surrounded by electrons in orbitals, expanding the atom to about 10 to the minus 10 meters across.
Yes, and the historical Bohr model is still useful for conceptualizing those discrete energy levels the electrons occupy, defining their stability in chemistry. Let's detail the three fundamental subatomic particles.
Okay, we have the proton, positive charge, found in the nucleus.
The neutron, neutral charge, slightly heavier, also in the nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
And the much lighter electron, negative charge, orbiting the nucleus.
The atomic number, Z, the number of protons, defines the element. The mass number, A, is the total number of nucleons.
Right, protons plus neutrons. And the variation in the neutron count gives us isotopes.
Isotopes of an element have the same number of protons, so they share nearly identical chemical properties.
Carbon-12 and carbon-14, for example, behave the same chemically. But their differing neutron counts give them different physical properties, crucially, different stability and different mass.
The question is, what force overcomes the incredibly fierce electromagnetic repulsion between all those positive protons crammed into that tiny nucleus?
That is the job of the strong nuclear force. It is dramatically stronger than the electromagnetic force, but its effective range is incredibly short, limited to just a few femtometers.
So as soon as the nucleons move slightly too far apart,
the strong force drops off and the electromagnetic repulsion takes over, leading to instability.
This brings us to the profound insight of nuclear physics, the mass defect.
When you measure the mass of a stable, intact nucleus, you find it is always slightly less than the sum of the masses of its constituent protons and neutrons measured individually.
Where did that mass go?
It was converted into energy, right? Or the binding energy via E equals mc squared.
Exactly. That missing mass, delta m, is transformed into binding energy. E binding equals delta m times c squared. This energy is the energy required to tear the nucleus apart.
And the scale of this is just enormous. The energy released in nuclear processes is roughly a million times greater than the energy involved in conventional chemical reactions.
And iron 56, sitting at the peak of the binding energy curve, is the most stable nucleus of all.
It is.
So chapter 8 focuses on the instability and decay process. We've covered the strong and electromagnetic forces. To understand decay, we must introduce the weak interaction.
The weak force is the third fundamental force relevant here. It governs the fundamental transformations of particles, specifically the conversion of a proton to a neutron or vice versa, and it is responsible for all neutrino interactions.
And the stability of a nucleus is plotted on the valley of stability.
Yes. The plot shows that stable light nuclei prefer an equal number of protons and neutrons, n is approximately z. But as the nucleus gets heavier, the long-range electromagnetic repulsion becomes more significant.
So it needs more neutrons to act as glue.
It forces the nucleus to incorporate a disproportionately larger number of neutrons to provide additional short-range strong force binding without adding more charge. Nuclei that lie outside this valley are unstable and undergo radioactive decay.
This spontaneous decay is a probabilistic process that follows the decay law.
The law states that the rate of decay is proportional to the number of radioactive nuclei present. This yields the signature exponential decay curve, N of T equals N naught E to the minus lambda T.
And this relationship defines the half-life.
The time required for half of the sample to decay.
Let's detail the three main decay modes as they showcase different physics.
First, alpha decay. This occurs mainly in heavy nuclei like uranium. The nucleus ejects an energetic bundle of two protons and two neutrons, a helium-4 nucleus.
So this reduces the atomic number by 2 and the mass number by 4.
Exactly. Then we have the beta decays, which require the weak force.
Beta minus decay.
That occurs when a nucleus has too many neutrons. A neutron converts into a proton, releasing an electron, and an electron antineutrino. Crucially, this increases the atomic number by 1, turning the element into its neighbor on the periodic table, but the mass number remains constant.
And the opposite is beta plus decay.
Right. If the nucleus has too many protons, a proton converts into a neutron, releasing a positron and a neutrino. This decreases the atomic number by 1.
And finally, gamma decay.
That's just simple nuclear de-excitation. The nucleus, often left in an excited state after another decay, drops to a lower energy state by emitting a high-energy photon, a gamma ray, with no change to its identity.
Chapter 9 is a necessary detour into the quantum rules governing the nucleus, which leads us directly to medical imaging. We have to understand intrinsic spin.
Spin is one of those deeply quantum properties. It's not the particle physically rotating like a top. It's an inherent fixed quantity of angular momentum. Protons, neutrons, and electrons are fermions and all have a spin of 12.
And because we are in the quantum world, we can't measure that spin arbitrarily. The angular momentum is quantized.
Yes. If you try to measure the spin component along any axis, say the z-axis, it can only ever point in one of a few very specific discrete directions.
So for a proton with spin 12,
it can only ever be measured as spin up plus 12 or spin down negative 12. It can't wobble in between.
The total angular momentum of the nucleus is the nuclear spin. And this determines whether an element is useful for technologies like MRI.
Absolutely essential. If a nucleus has an even number of protons and an even number of neutrons, like carbon-12, the spins pair up and cancel out, resulting in a total spin of 0.
They're NMR silent.
Useless for magnetic resonance. Nuclei, like hydrogen-1 with a spin of 12, have a net spin and are the core of MRI.
Since the nucleus is essentially a spinning charge, this motion creates a small magnetic field, which we call the magnetic moment.
You can visualize the nucleus as a tiny bar magnet. When you place this bar magnet in an external magnetic field, it interacts with that field. The potential energy of this interaction is minimized when the magnetic moment aligns itself with the external field.
And this alignment.
This principle of alignment and the subsequent energy difference between the aligned and anti-aligned states is the entire foundation of magnetic resonance.
So now we move into the theoretical framework that explains those rules, quantum mechanics in Chapter 10.
Quantum mechanics fundamentally asserts quantization, that energy and angular momentum aren't continuous, but come in discrete packets. Energy comes in minimum packets proportional to frequency, E equals HF, and angular momentum is also quantized in units of H-bar.
And the core description of any quantum system is its wave function, psi.
Psi is a complex mathematical function, and while we can't measure it directly, we use the Born rule to interpret it. The square of the wave function's magnitude gives us the probability density of finding the particle at a specific location.
So this is the official introduction of probability into the description of physical reality.
It is. To extract any measurable physical information from that probability map, we need mathematical tools called operators.
Physical observables are represented by operators. If you want to know the particle's momentum, you use the momentum operator.
And if you want to know the system's total energy, you use the energy operator, called the Hamiltonian.
And when we apply the Hamiltonian to the wave function, we get the Schrödinger equation.
Focusing on the time-independent form, this equation describes the allowed stationary states of the system.
Mm.
If the system is in an eigenstate, it has a definite measurable energy value.
Solving the Schrödinger equation for an atom gives you its specific discrete energy levels.
That's right. But just because energy levels exist doesn't mean electrons or particles can jump between any two of them. We have selection rules.
These rules are derived from fundamental conservation laws, like the conservation of angular momentum.
Yes. They dictate which quantum transitions, the absorption or emission of a photon, are allowed and which are forbidden. An electron is usually only allowed to move one unit of orbital angular momentum up or down during a transition.
Chapter 11 is the application of these rules to the massive technology of magnetic resonance imaging.
Step 1 requires placing a sample, like a human body, full of hydrogen-1 protons into a strong, static B-naught field. This is the giant magnet in the MRI machine.
The magnetic moments of those protons align themselves either parallel, low energy, or anti-parallel, high energy, to that B-naught field.
The separation of energy levels is called Zeeman splitting. The energy gap between the spin-up and spin-down states is directly proportional to the strength of the magnetic field. This separation is tiny, but vital.
Simultaneously, all those tiny magnetic moments start to precess or wobble around the B-naught field axis.
Like a slightly tilted spinning top. That frequency of wobble is the Larmor frequency.
And that's the natural frequency of the spin system.
It is, defined by the gyromagnetic ratio and the magnetic field strength. This is the critical frequency we must match to achieve resonance. For protons in a 1.5 Tesla clinical scanner, that Larmor frequency is about 63.87 megahertz, squarely in the radio frequency band.
So we know the natural frequency of the system. To get a signal, we use RF excitation.
We apply a short burst of electromagnetic energy, an RF pulse tuned exactly to the Larmor frequency. This resonance condition provides the energy needed to flip some of the lower energy spins.
It also does something else, right? It forces them into phase.
Yes, it creates coherence, tipping the net bulk magnetization away from the main axis and into the transverse, or XY plane.
And once that vector is precessing in the transverse plane, it acts like a tiny oscillating current, which induces a measurable voltage in the receiver coils. That's the raw MR signal.
As soon as the RF pulse is turned off, the system begins its exponential return to equilibrium, a process called relaxation. This is the ultimate source of all image contrast in MRI.
We have two critical time constants governing this relaxation, T1 and T2.
T1 relaxation, spin lattice, describes the recovery of the magnetization along the main axis. This happens as the excited spins transfer their excess energy back to the surrounding molecular environment, or lattice.
And T2 relaxation, spin, describes the decay of the measurable signal in the transverse plane.
T2 decay happens due to microscopic magnetic field inhomogeneities and spins magnetically interacting and dephasing each other. They go out of sync.
And different tissues have different T1 and T2 values.
Crucially, tissues that contain highly mobile water, like a tumor or cerebrospinal fluid, have very different T1 and T2 values than dense tissues, like fat or muscle. By carefully timing the RF pulses, we can exploit these differences to generate incredibly high contrast images.
So we're effectively mapping the distribution and mobility of water molecules in the body.
That is exactly what we are doing.
Since we mentioned water is key to MRI contrast, Chapter 12 explores its unique electrical properties.
Water is famous because it's a highly asymmetrical molecule. The two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom create a bending shape, pulling electron density toward the oxygen atom.
This separation of charge creates a permanent molecular dipole moment.
It is a polar molecule, acting like a tiny battery with a positive end and a negative end. This permanent dipole means water molecules interact strongly with electric fields, specifically via rotational modes.
In liquid water, these molecules constantly try to rotate and align themselves with any external electric field.
But hydrogen bonding and constant collisions, viscosity, hinder this rotation.
And this mechanism is why a microwave oven works, based on dielectric loss.
When water is exposed to a rapidly alternating electromagnetic field microwaves, typically at 2.45 gigahertz, the dipoles try desperately to follow the field and flip back and forth.
But because the movement is hindered by friction,
the rotation lags slightly behind the oscillating electric field.
And that lag is critical.
That lag dissipates energy. The energy from the electromagnetic wave is constantly being converted into the kinetic energy of the water molecules, which we perceive as heat. The rate of this absorption is described by the imaginary part of the complex permittivity. That term represents the amount of energy that is lost or soaked up by the material.
That strong frequency-dependent absorption explains why radar signals, cell signals, and other communications are heavily attenuated by rain or even dense fog.
Absolutely. The absorption capacity is powerful. While water's theoretical absorption peak might be around 20 gigahertz, it has a strong, broad absorption across the entire microwave band, meaning any high-frequency EM signal traveling through atmospheric water vapor or rain is going to lose significant power.
We finish this deep dive by looking at how radiation interacts with matter and the ultimate limits imposed on us when trying to measure a physical property.
The interaction between radiation, like photons, and matter can be broken down into two main types: elastic scattering, where kinetic energy is conserved,
and inelastic scattering, where energy is transferred to the target's internal state.
Let's start with an elastic scattering phenomenon we see every day. Really scattering.
This happens when light interacts with particles much smaller than its own wavelength, such as nitrogen and oxygen molecules in the atmosphere.
And the intensity of this scattering is proportional to the inverse of the wavelength raised to the fourth power, 1/λ^4.
That's a massive dependence, so why does that matter conversationally?
Because the wavelength of blue light is roughly half that of red light. If you raise that factor of 2^4, it means blue light is scattered approximately 16 times more efficiently than red light.
Which is why the sky is blue.
The short wavelength blue light is scattered everywhere by the air molecules. At sunset, the light travels through so much atmosphere that the blue is entirely scattered away, leaving only the long wavelength reds and oranges to reach our eyes.
And then, moving to inelastic scattering, energy is transferred.
Right. Compton scattering is key here. A high-energy photon collides with an electron, transferring some energy and momentum to the electron, and the photon is scattered with a lower energy and consequently a longer wavelength.
And there is Raman scattering.
Raman scattering is an important spectroscopic tool. It involves a photon colliding with a molecule and either gaining or losing a tiny amount of energy, corresponding exactly to the discrete vibrational or rotational energy transitions within that target molecule,
allowing scientists to map the chemical structure of a substance.
Exactly. For total energy transfer, we look at absorption mechanisms like the photoelectric effect.
Here, the photon is completely absorbed by an atom, causing an electron to be ejected. This process dominates at lower photon energies.
At the opposite end, when photons have extremely high energy, they can exhibit pair production, converting their energy entirely into an electron-positron pair near a nucleus.
And we can apply these absorption and reflection concepts directly to technology, specifically radar applications.
Radar relies on reflection. Highly conductive surfaces, like metals, have very small skin depths, meaning EM waves are reflected almost entirely.
Stealth technology, however, uses radar absorbent material, or RAM.
RAM is carefully engineered to absorb the incoming microwave energy, often leveraging the dielectric loss mechanism we discussed with water, converting the EM energy into thermal energy and preventing it from reflecting back to the enemy's radar receiver.
So chapter 14 connects our micro world quantum concepts back to the macro world property of temperature using statistical mechanics.
It does. And temperature is fundamentally a measure of thermal motion.
At any temperature above absolute zero, atoms and molecules are in constant random motion.
And temperature T is directly proportional to the average random kinetic energy of those particles.
This randomness means we can't predict the path of a single particle, only the probable distribution of the collective. This is described by the Boltzmann distributions.
The Boltzmann distribution states that for any system in thermal equilibrium, the probability of occupying an energy state is exponentially proportional to the negative of that energy divided by the thermal energy.
So lower energy states are always more populated than higher energy states.
Always. This principle governs how quickly a system settles down after being disturbed, described by relaxation times.
Which brings us right back to MRI.
It does. The T1 relaxation time in MRI is a perfect real-world example of this statistical mechanic concept applied at the quantum level.
And now we must explicitly connect this back to Chapter 11. The entire MRI signal depends on the tiny population differences dictated by the Boltzmann distribution.
This is the crux of the connection. In the two-level spin system spin-up and spin-down, the energy gap created by the magnetic field is incredibly small compared to the natural thermal energy of the body.
So according to Boltzmann, the ratio of the spin populations is extremely close to one.
Extremely. If you have a million spins, you might only have 3 or 4 more aligned spins than anti-aligned spins.
So the measurable net magnetization that we tip into the transverse plane and that generates the MRI signal is entirely dependent on that minuscule excess population in the lower energy state.
Without that small statistical difference, there is no signal. This difference increases if the magnetic field strength increases or if the temperature decreases. This is why high-field MRI scanners are so powerful, because they increase that energy gap and boost the signal dictated by Boltzmann's law.
Finally, Chapter 15 addresses the ultimate practical hurdle for any measurement device, whether it's a radio antenna or an MRI coil, distinguishing what you want to hear from the background chatter. This is measured by the signal-to-noise ratio, SNR.
SNR is the ratio of the power of the desired signal to the power of the unwanted noise. It's a measure of data quality. We need high SNR for a reliable measurement, typically defined as an SNR greater than 3.
For weak quantum signals like MRI, the primary method for improving SNR is signal averaging.
This is a beautiful piece of statistics. When you sum and repeated measurements, the useful deterministic signal adds up linearly by a factor of n. But the random uncorrelated noise only adds up by the square root of n.
So your overall SNR improves only by the square root of n.
Right. If you average 100 scans, you only achieve a tenfold increase in signal quality. This is a fundamental trade-off engineers face between image quality and scan time.
The detection limits are fundamentally set by the inherent noise of the universe. What are the two main types of noise we deal with?
The main limiters are thermal noise, which is the random jitter caused by the thermal agitation of electrons in any conductor, and shot noise, which arises from the fact that charge and energy arrive in discrete packets, electrons and photons, not as a smooth, continuous flow.
Analyzing these signals is the realm of spectroscopy.
Yes, the study of the interaction between EM radiation and matter as a function of frequency or wavelength. It allows us to identify substances by their unique electromagnetic fingerprint, whether we are looking at the energy they absorb or the light they emit when excited.
And finally, why are the spectral lines we measure never perfectly sharp? We have line broadening.
The lines have width for several physical reasons. Natural broadening is a direct consequence of the uncertainty principle. If an energy state only exists for a very short lifetime, the uncertainty in its energy must be large, making the line broad.
And the other two are related to motion and environment.
Doppler broadening occurs because the thermal motion of the atoms in the sample shifts the observed frequency relative to the detector, smearing the line. And inhomogeneous broadening occurs due to slight variations in the local environment, like magnetic field non-uniformity across a large MRI sample, causing different parts of the sample to resonate at slightly different frequencies.
We successfully navigated through 15 foundational chapters, starting from the basic definitions of measurement mass, length, time journeyed through Newton's laws, unified electricity and light via Maxwell, plunged into the probabilistic world of quantum spin, and finished with the practical limits of detection governed by noise and statistical mechanics.
We covered a lot of ground.
We covered enormous ground in a single deep dive.
What's truly fascinating here is how these 15 chapters build on one another, creating a single cohesive view of the physical world. The principles of energy conservation underpin every single transformation we discussed, from a falling object to a nuclear decay.
And MRI, as you said, relies on all of it.
It relies entirely on the connections between classical forces, quantum angular momentum, and the statistical laws of population difference.
It all comes back to that tiny imbalance, the result of the Boltzmann distribution.
Absolutely. The net magnetization vector that makes MRI possible is only a tiny fraction of the total spins, entirely dependent on that minuscule excess population in the lower energy state dictated by Chapter 14. This raises an important question.
Go on.
If we can magically cool a biological system down, pushing the thermal energy, KBT, closer to zero, without causing the system to freeze or be destroyed, which is currently impossible in a medical setting, how much more powerful and higher resolution could our quantum measurements become simply by dramatically increasing that tiny, precious population difference?
Wow.
The difference between life-saving medical detail and a weak signal is entirely governed by the battle between quantum energy gaps and thermal noise.